Houston, we have a podcast. Welcome to the official podcast of the NASA Johnson Space Center, episode 405, Building the International Space Station. I'm Gary Jordan, and I'll be your host for this episode. On this podcast, we bring in the experts, scientists, engineers, and astronauts, all to let you know what's going on in the world of human spaceflight and more. We've recently hit a monumental milestone. Expedition 1 began November 2nd, 2000, which means that November 2nd, 2025 marks 25 years of a continuous human presence aboard the International Space Station. And to celebrate that, we are dedicating multiple upcoming episodes to covering different aspects of the ISS and how we got to where we are today. For a quarter of a century, the station has been a hub of scientific discovery, international partnership, and technological innovation. It's where humans from across the globe have come together to live and work in space, pushing the boundaries of what's possible. But getting to this point wasn't easy. Building the International Space Station as one of the most ambitious engineering projects in history, requiring decades of planning, international cooperation, and some of the brightest minds in human spaceflight. In the first episode of our ISS 25 series, we'll talk with former ISS program manager and co-founder of Axiom Space, Michael Suffredini, who played pivotal roles in turning the dream of a space station into reality as a space station program manager from 2005 to 2015, overseeing the completion of assembly to the transition to utilization. We'll hear how he led through challenges, fostered global partnerships, and set the foundation for the next era of human space exploration. Let's get started.
T-minus 5 seconds and counting. Mark. Mission start. T-0. Launch commit light circle.
There she goes.
Houston, we have a podcast.
Mike Suffredini, thank you so much for coming on Houston, We Have a Podcast to help us kick off 25 years of the International Space Station and human presence on board. Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
It's you have quite a history with the International Space Station program. There is a reason you are here to help us to kick this off. I want to start off, though, like I usually do with our guests, and helping our listeners to get to know a little bit about you. We're going to go a little farther back and start biographical before we get into the International Space Station. Want our listeners to get to know a little bit about you growing up and what helped you to get to where you are today, and that passion for space exploration that led you to, I guess, what we're going to talk about here primarily is being a program manager of the International Space Station and following along that path and getting to where you are, if you don't mind starting there.
Yeah, no problem. This is a story that doesn't usually start off the way most of the space people want to hear it start off, because they want to hear that, you know, I watched Armstrong touch foot on the moon and was ready to go to be a space guy. I did watch him touch foot on the moon, and I was very blown away by it, even at the young age I was at the time. But really, I went to the University of Texas and majored in aerospace engineering because of planes. I thought I wanted to work on high-performance jets, really. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until I was about 2 or 3 years in that I took a course called Orbital Dynamics, which is a difficult course, but a fascinating course. And the gentleman who taught that, his name's Victor Zebehe at the University of Texas. He's now passed with, but he was, the way he taught and the things he taught us that we could do was just fascinating. Mm-hmm. And that kind of started leading me towards the space side of things. So when I got ready to graduate, I interviewed not only with different aerospace and helicopter companies, but also with NASA, McDonnell Douglas, and Lockheed Martin. Ultimately, I ended up here as in operations, actually, is how I started off my career. Mm-hmm. And then I moved on the payload side of things a little bit, teaching, really doing training was what I came on to start doing. And I did training in various different applications. IUS was a big thing, and so there was training of different programs, even helped the Air Force out some. And then ultimately, I became a civil servant in 89 when Shuttle was picking back up after the Challenger accident, mm-hmm. and they needed people to manage what they called the mission evaluation room. That's where the engineers were that, you know, followed the mission and gave advice to the operations guys about what to do. And then after the shuttle landed, we did a lot of work to recover and fix things and then get ready for the next flight. And so that's really how I ended up as a civil servant. And then from there, I was in human spaceflight all along through, well, the ops was all human spaceflight, of course, but shuttle, I stayed with shuttle for a number of years. Eventually ended up as a manager, space shuttle program manager. Mm-hmm. At the time, they had directors, so I was an assistant manager. I wasn't the program manager. Okay. I worked for Brewster Shaw and Tommy Holloway. Great people, by the way. I learned so much from them, and they really are the, when you start thinking about the people that really push us along, those are a couple of big, big managers along with George Abbey. Mm-hmm. And speaking of George, George was the one that decided it was time for me to go over into the space station. So in 1994, George asked that, well, they didn't ask at the time. I asked if I could say no, and Harvey Hartman said, well, that's an option, but it's, it limits your future a bit, maybe. But anyway, so they asked me to come over, and so I came over. At the time, Randy Brinkley was the program manager. Shep had just left maybe 6 months later, moved on to be an astronaut. He was the program manager way back at the beginning. And then from there, it's just been an interesting ride. I started off in the budget office of all places. Then about 6 months in, Randy brought me in and said, hey, we want you to start this thing. You know, we're building this program to build, to do research and science on board. We're not really thinking about that very clearly. I want you to come in. We'll put ops and all this payload and research stuff together. And so I created this, what we called the ISS research office. And I think it started off as ISS payloads office, and then eventually we changed the name. And I did that for about 3 years, and it was a fascinating job because really we were affecting the design of the lab, and the lab's design was way far along. And so we were trying to come in and say, okay, here's where we have to plant our flags. These are the things we can do that we must do, and here's the things we don't have to do. The research guys were actually spending money way faster than the program was building. Mm-hmm. So, in fact, when I took it over, our budget was over $2 billion. It was just a fascinating thing. But anyway, and then after that, Tommy asked me to go to the vehicle, what we call the vehicle office. And that was right when we started flying. We had launched, FGB had launched, the Node had launched. And Z1 launched. Actually, I was in the vehicle office for the Z1 launch. And then I was there through many, many elements that flew all the way up through. I moved on right before a P1 flew, so we did the lab and Z1 launched about the time I was coming over. But the lab and P6, which was a huge accomplishment, and then we had research, not research. We had missions that brought up the arm, and we did. We brought up supplies and some of these things, and then we started building out the truss. Anyways, just a fascinating time. We did some amazing things to get this hardware ready to go fly, and we learned a lot along the way. It really was truly fascinating. And then from there, I became the head of operations, and I did that for several years. And then eventually, Gerst asked me to be his deputy, and so I was deputy to Gerst until 2005, where he was told that he was supposed to go to headquarters, and then that's when I became program manager and did that for the next 10 years.
All over the place, Saf. You were, I think what eventually, what I'm seeing is a trend of what led to your eventual placement in 2005, I believe, as the program manager, is this experience in operations, in management. You did a little bit of research, the engineering side of things, whether it be from the mission evaluation room or from the vehicle office. There's all of these different components. The International Space Station being as complex of a complex as it is, you seeing so many different parts of it is really looking after the team that is managing more into the details, but knowing the right questions to ask and knowing the right people to do it. So it was a little bit of that, and that wide experience maybe led to eventually that placement as the program manager.
Certainly, actually, and it played a major role in this crazy idea. I had to go, you know, build the first commercial space station,
sure,
which was the founding of Axiom, and it was basically because of all the things I had experienced and have an opportunity to do, including the work with the partners, that led me to this point where I said, well, there's a way to do this commercially where we can save money and still be safe, and, you know, this is going to have to happen at some point. So that's really what drove me to think that I could do something as profound as start a company that's going to build the first commercial space station, and we're still going, so that's awesome.
And I want to see, and I want to tell the story and revisit some of these moments in your career all the way through ISS and then do get to commercial stations and how this is really paving for future exploration as well, even 25 years later of continuous human presence. But going back in your career especially to the early years, you said you went to the station program in 94. This is really spinning up the program. You already had experience in shuttle. There was, you know, shuttle Mir was around this time. So there were these lower Earth orbit operations that eventually led to this idea of international space station. I wonder if you can sort of help us to understand the whole landscape of things around the time of your career and your time in the International Space Station, as we are, you know, working with our Russian partners and FGB as a collaborative endeavor, and some of those early years of construction. You mentioned Z1P1. You mentioned these early assembly missions and these components of International Space Station, bringing them together. Your perspective of those early years from your post in the program at the time?
Well, remember, I started in the program after we had decided to bring the Russians on board. And, of
right.
course, we were going through
Alpha Freedom, Phase 1
and all that. And so that's when I really stepped into the program. And at that point, to what you said, when I look back on what we said we were going to do, it's pretty phenomenal because we had all of these components that were going to be built by the international partners, and somehow they were all going to get to orbit and plug in and work. And when you just think about that intellectually, it scares you, you know, and that's really the thing. And you can't do it until you can get all the engineers in a room. And what's fascinating and what I learned through this whole process is, when you put engineers in a room, it's amazing how quickly they can talk to each other because they're using the same equations, you know, stress analysis. How you do it's a little different. Some do things a bit different, but the equations are the same. The assumptions are the same. What you go through, very, very similar. And that was probably what made this early on technically viable, was that engineers really talk the same language. So when you put them all in a room, that's probably the linchpin that let us technically be able to do this. Now, what really allowed that to happen was the politics of the day. So, with the wall falling, there was a big push to bring the Russians in and participate. We knew we were going to have to help fund them, but we wanted their space program to continue to be robust. And that play in politics was really the green light that NASA had to go do the many things we did over the years. And it's what we were allowed to do when nobody else was is pretty phenomenal. And I can just remember conversations later on with leadership at NASA, you know, every 2 or 3 years, leadership's changing out, particularly the highest level leadership. And I can remember a conversation with one of our heads of what we called it, HOMD, I think at that time, it was Human Spaceflight and Operations, was all in one. And I won't mention his name, but he came in and sat down and said, okay, well, we want to do something this way. And we kind of said, well, okay, but we need to talk to the partners. And they're, well, we're in charge, right? So, well, we're not completely in charge. We have responsibilities, including the safety of the vehicle. So NASA had this authority around safety. And if it was a safety decision, we said this is the way we're going to do it. That's what all the partners are supposed to do. But when it came to technical solutions, although we were building a lot of the space station and we were providing the infrastructure that most of the users would use, we still had to work with the partners. So we were trying to make a decision about something that was going to fly on a Progress. And I can remember we were not in sync with our Russian partners on this item, and I don't want to get to the item or the leadership that was involved, but there was something that they had loaded onto the Progress that we didn't think was safe. And so we, you know, told our Russian friends who told us their opinion, and it was that it's safe and it's, you know, loaded and they're ready to go fly, and, you know, they don't really like to sit around and not fly if they can help it. And so we had to go to our leadership headquarters and say, look, we're doing this. This is where we're at. This is why we were concerned. This is what we got the Russians to agree to do, but still it's flying. And I remember him just as clear as day saying, just tell them it's not launching. We had to say, Gers was with me, and we had to just kind of help him understand that that really wasn't an, I mean, we can say it, but it may not make a difference. You know, if you can't prove that, you know, this is a serious safety issue, then, you know, and we couldn't convince them that it was. So that, just being in that position where we built a space station that differing numbers, but anywhere, let's call it $150 billion that was spent by this government to build a space station, and we don't have complete control over everything that goes on board, that is unfathomable today. It's just not, there's no way that anybody would ever agree to that today. But that was the foundation of the partnership. We couldn't reach agreement to get 15 countries to play together unless we recognize that all the countries had a say. And to limit to varying degrees, it had to always work. And because we owned most of the infrastructure, that was an easy conversation. We just said, well, the infrastructure doesn't support it, or it does. But then it came to some things that were very sovereign oriented, and you had to accept that they have reasons why they're spending a lot of money themselves on the space station, and you have to respect that. So you have to figure out how to work through that. Mm-hmm. I tell people all the time, they say, what is the biggest thing to come out of space station? And I always say it's the partnership. It's how we work together. Still work together, and it's really trying now. I'm glad I'm not the program manager right now. Those guys are really challenged with the politics around it, and they're doing a great job, fantastic job. But that's the foundation of everything going forward. Going to Mars has got to be done by the planet. Can't be done by a handful of countries that agree to play. We got to get together and do this as humanity, and it starts with what we do with ISS. So it's we should be very proud of that.
It's still something that we talk about today, and actually one of the themes I certainly wanted to reach as we're talking about this is this international component. It was fascinating to hear you talk about that, because I've highlighted a couple of moments in your career talking about all these different skills, and maybe more from a technical and knowledge perspective, the operational side, maybe the research side, maybe the engineering side, and then, of course, a certain leadership style, but it sounded like there was, even in the early days of International Space Station, a reframing and maybe a potential culture shift in how we approach a problem. Rather than the directive of just make this work and just do it, this idea, when we talk about and we use the phrase international collaboration, the stories that you're saying of how we talk to each other and how we work out problems, that is what collaboration looks like. It's not just directing and demanding. It is that give and take. It's the negotiation to come to a common understanding. And why we talk about the International Space Station, even, you know, 25 years later, as this beacon of collaboration and a peaceful endeavor, right? That's what you're talking about, is how you work together. That's what it looks like.
Yeah. And that story I just told you was one of very, very, very few instances in my 20 years in ISS where we didn't really see eye to eye on something. So many, and you see it particularly in operations. I led the operations group for 4 years or so as a program manager responsible for operations. And that is very real time. You don't have time to go, hey, let's go chat about it. See, well, sometimes you did, but sometimes you didn't. We worked through many, many, many issues together as a partnership and worked through them successfully. And so that instance I gave you is really, even though we have lots of challenging ones, we always seem to find a spot where we can both get comfortable and go forward. And that's just the team and people who've done that both from this country and others. They deserve a huge amount of credit for that. And the politicians that said this was so important that we're going to put this unprecedented relationship together to spend an unprecedented amount of money, you know, that deserves, when people look back and say, why was this successful? That's a key part of it. Mm-hmm. That foundation doesn't exist today. And that was a bold statement based on the politics of the day. And it really held for many, many years.
That's right.
Yeah.
Lead into your years as a program manager, but thinking about this and staying with this theme here on this collaborative approach and enabling the success and that ultimately led to get us to today of 25 years of continuous human presence. I wonder what you learned throughout the years prior to becoming program manager that sort of shaped your leadership style that ultimately would be the style that you put forth for the 10 years that you served as program manager, 2005 to 2015. I wonder, you know, we're talking about collaboration, we're talking about this evolution of culture, and then, of course, in your years as program manager, you see through a shift of International Space Station from this assembly phase to more of a utilization, and all right, we built it, now let's go do the science, and this reframing just even in the middle of your tenure. I wonder if you can elaborate on the leadership approach that you took and that you learned from for those years.
You know, I've been really blessed with the opportunities I've had. And I can't say that I planned out my career. You talk to people and they'll say, yeah, when I graduate, I'm going to do this and I'm going to do that. And I knew any of that. I just came in. This was a cool job. And, you know, people offered me the next job. And I had a sense for what I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. I was always more of the big picture guy that was trying to get the big picture put together. I could do the nuts and bolts stuff. It just wasn't that interesting to me. So I'll just tell you a little bit about it. And shuttle. As a manager, I kind of learned that, you know, there's a certain kind of structure and you need to listen to everybody, make them feel like you heard them, and then put forth an answer that everybody could get comfortable with. And if you didn't, you didn't fly. And so that was kind of one of the early things I learned. I came over to the space station and, you know, I learned quite a bit in the finance world, being 6 months in finance, but other than that, it was really about just taking care of the people was one of the big things that we learned, because the leader at the time was a little rambunctious. He would just run, and, you know, the people didn't matter that much. And I was like, whoa, so a little bit of people. But probably one of the biggest things that stuck with me was what I learned in the research side and in the vehicle side. On the research side, you know, I came to a group of people, and at first they were kind of sibling, but they were very, shy is not the right word, but they just assumed things they couldn't happen. You know, their research, their second fiddle. George didn't care about research. He cared about building the space station. Everybody assumed the research money would be stolen from him eventually when the space station development ran out of money and all these kinds of things. And one of the biggest things I'd like to think that I put into that team was, no, we're deciding what's going to happen on board. We're making those decisions. Nobody else is. And they don't get to say no. If they want to say no, they can explain why, and then we can decide what we're going to do about that. But you guys are assuming that the answer is always no, that you're limited in what you can do. And what I hope that I left them with, and I think I did over the 3 years that I did that job, was no, we have a responsibility. We're not building the space. When we're done building the space station, we're not done. That's not the end. That's the means to an end. The end is what we're doing. That's what you got to make sure happens. And if we get to the end and we can't do research, we screwed up. So I like to think that was one of the biggest things I learned, was you really have to help a team drive themselves. And that's a big part of what I did. And then I got in the vehicle world, and wow, the next big thing I probably figured out was we have a lot of safety constraints at NASA. Left to its own devices, you wouldn't fly. You know, you really got to drive the team. And so you start asking questions like, here's a good example. P1, we had P1 and S1, and these were the first truss pieces that attached to the station, put together, attached to the station. So when we had S0 and then we had P1, and so S0 was a nightmare because we had, I mean, it was already tough enough to put the structure together, but the blankets on that thing was, we were taking blankets, trying to put them on, they wouldn't fit. So we would take the blanket off and somebody would turn that into a description of what didn't work. Then they send it to the engineers who would re-engineer the blanket. And then some sewing person would go sew the re-engineering drawing. And then somebody would eventually get the new blanket and stick it up there and go, oh, it's a, just an inch off. So then you'd start this, no kidding, this is what we were doing. And so, you know, you start to ask yourself, why is it so important to do all this engineering? Just get up there. If it doesn't fit, bring the sew person and see, you know, can they stitch an extra piece on? Can they just recut it and do it right quick? And they're, oh my God, well, the engineering won't reflect what's on orbit. So to what end? Why do I care? There's never going to be another P1 ever built in the history of the program. Why do I care if we know exactly what the blankets look like that are covering this spacecraft? And this was all driven by the design, engineering, and safety community. So I learned pretty quickly in that they're so conservative that you did have flexibility, but you just had to drive the team to get that flexibility up. And that's probably what drove my management style all the way through ISS program. But in the end, we drove the team to do things that we otherwise wouldn't have been able to do. And it's because we had the margin, because we had built a spacecraft with so much robustness in most areas, not all, most. And we always had these safety functions, so much safety in everything. And so, you know, I wanted to fly a vacuum cleaner. So they were ready to go design a new vacuum cleaner. So the one on orbit, I said, no. Go to Best Buy. Go buy the 3 best small vacuum cleaners and bring them over. By then, we had I had convinced the team to build adapters so that we could plug. You know, we had DC voltage on orbit. We had AC voltage and DC voltage, and so we built basically extension cords so that we could plug in AC plugs on orbit. Which, of course, you can imagine the safety conversation that was all about, right? So you know, the friction fit, you know, where are they going to go? You know, you plug them in, they just stay, you know. But no, we had Velcro straps to hold them in. But anyway, I got my plugs on orbit. And then the next was how you use it. So safety razors, well, it's just a charger. You plug it in, doesn't use much current, no big deal. But then I was going for the vacuum cleaner. The next big step in that was the vacuum cleaner. And, well, they were like, the engineers came back, sat me down, said, oh, we just don't know how well it's built. I said, okay. Tell you what you do. Build, buy two, rip open one of them, see how you feel about it. If it's good design, then that'll be the one we fly. So I made that, we got past that. All right, we might be able to live with that. So I went, you know, and I said, buy 3 or 4. I don't care. They're hundreds of dollars compared to the millions of dollars we'd spend on a vacuum cleaner. They didn't work very well. And so we did that. In the end, we flew a vacuum. I don't remember which one we ended up picking. I didn't really care which one we picked, just as long as it worked good, was quiet, and did the job. And the last thing I had to do to get somebody over the top, and I won't tell you who the gentleman is, but a gentleman called me responsible for this function, was he said, if you could just agree to let us wrap the cord with Kapton tape, I can get the team to be okay. I was like, fine. This was a phone call at night. And I said, fine, you go do that. So we flew our vacuum cleaner. And that seems like such a silly small thing, but that was such a major shift in our ability to use computers, laptops, everything now that's chargeable. We can fly to orbit and just use it the way it is. We didn't do any of that early on. Mm-hmm. Everything had to be redesigned with very, very few exceptions, if not completely designed from scratch. So anyway, it you really have to drive the team and think about the margins that are in the design. And NASA there's a lot of margin in station. There's areas where there's not a lot of margin, but there's quite a bit of margin in the station design, and we just had to figure out how to use that to our advantage, and saves you money, gives you flexibility. I mean, the laptops we fly, we don't modify. We used to modify the flat laptops. We'd tear them open, code them, do all this crazy stuff to them. And I'd be like, okay, bought the laptops. Why aren't they on orbit? Well, we've got them in the lab. We got them torn apart. I went in there. Sure enough, they had them all ripped apart. They were coding them and doing, I've forgotten all them. Oh, they were changing the plug. The plug, you know, that goes into the back. You know, they all have this little, it's friction fit plug, but that wasn't good enough. They had a, it had to have a captive fastener. I was like, no. No, let's not do that, you know? So these are things just automatically happened. And so what you had to do was dig in, and then you start talking about why and why you thought it might be okay, and then they have to think about it for a while. But that's that was a big part of what I learned through my whole period of time as program manager was you just need to make sure that you get everybody thinking the way you're thinking. It's possible to do these things in a different way. And if we do it this way, we get so much more flexibility. You look at what we do on Space Station today, it's not anything like what we started off to think. And that's a good thing. That's a good thing.
This is, I think, you know, some of the questions I have here is thinking about the legacy of the International Space Station and leading to the future of low Earth orbit and commercial and all the things that we're seeing today in the 2020s now. But when it comes to that legacy, you know, and I feel like we could explore the vacuum cleaner story, for example, and just take tangents on each one of those problems and tell those stories, right?
Yeah.
But what we're leading to is you know, it's a culture shift. It's a shift in a way of thinking and a change and an evolution of the way of doing business, getting leaner, getting smarter, getting more efficient, using instead of inventing something, using a commercial off-the-shelf solution and rethinking how to do it safely, but also in a way that it maybe is a little bit faster, maybe is a little bit cheaper, maybe is something that could be affordable for commercial companies down the future whenever that time comes. And of course, we're going to explore that time. There's a lot of these pivotal moments in your career, and I want to jump to your time as the program manager. You're taking over in 2005. This is return to flight time frame. Very dynamic time at NASA. I wonder if you can take us to that moment, your first year as the program manager, the culture at the time, and then your approach to seeing through the completion of ISS assembly.
Yeah, that's interesting because when the accident happened, Gersten and I got together that evening and said, okay, we got a progress flying in a couple of days. You know, is there something we need on there? Because now we know we're not going to shuttle for a while. What do we need to do? So there's immediate reaction to that. And that was back in 2003. And so over that period from 2003 till when Gers left and I became program manager, we really were worried about the logistics of the station and the vehicles that could fly and how we took care of everything. You know, we brought the crew down in size and flew two crew for a while and all those kinds of things. So return to flight was really a particularly challenging time for the agency, as we all know. We really struggled with, you know, what is safe enough to fly? You know, this is what we got kind of hung up in. What is safe enough? And I can remember lots of things I could talk about. We don't have enough time to do it, but we had a lot of conversations about issues, and issues would pop up. We'd go to FRRs and issues would pop up, and then, you know, we would, oh my God, not that's possible, I guess, so let's go look at it. And we'd do this over and over again. I'll do one anecdote because I love this anecdote. Mike Griffin was the head of the agency, really the right guy to try to get us flying again. He was really, really good. He was a little caustic sometimes, but he was really, really good. And I love the man for a lot of things that he did. But I can remember one of the biggest things we were trying to do is get engineers to talk about what they're concerned about and not worry about how leadership felt about it. It was kind of one of the key drivers to the issue that we dealt with with the accident. And so we were particularly sensitive. I can remember one FRR, some engineer came in with one of these issues. It was another tile possible to, you know, maybe come off issue. And so went to FRR, and we said, okay, well, we you know, we're not ready to go fly yet. So now Mike has to go have this meeting with the press. And the press gave me, said, look, somebody, the system worked. And the engineer said he's got a concern. He brought it forward. We're now looking at it. We'll let you know. And people really wanted to know who the person was. And try as Mike could, he kept saying, look, as much as I love to sit in front of you guys and talk about this, if I told every engineer that brought a story forward to us that they'd have to then press talk to you guys about it, he said nobody would bring things forward. And I can remember him being harassed and harassed. And I thought he was going to get upset. But finally he said, well, I guess he was upset, but he was very calmly. He just said, well, look, I can explain it to you, but I can't understand it for you. And I think the whole agency, I think after that was like, we're 100% behind Mike. He just, you know, he's really a driver.
I heard that one too. Yeah.
So he, you know, the point in all that was to say that at that time we were frozen in our tracks. And I can remember a moment at an FRR where we were starting to work another problem. And I had to stand up, and it was probably one of the hardest things I did early on as a program manager. I said, look, sitting on the ground is not an option. We're talking like that's the safe option. We've got a spacecraft on orbit that can't keep operating the way it is. We have an obligation to start flying again. So, and Mike, God bless Mike, he was like 100%. He said, you're exactly right. We got it. It's not okay to just say we're sitting on the ground till it's ready. That's not okay. We got to go figure out what safe enough was. And that was probably the biggest early challenge I had. We were worrying about all the components that had to fly next, and they were all lined up to go, but are they ready to fly? When are they going to fly? We were busy deciding that the shuttle program wasn't going to go much longer, so what are we going to cut out? We had a lot of things that we were working on, but the biggest thing was just to get flying again. And that was and really the shuttle program did that. Us station guys did what we did, but it mm-hmm. was the shuttle program had to figure that out. And it was probably it took really a driving force to make that happen. And I think Michael Griffin deserves a lot of credit for really just pushing the team and eventually saying, okay, this is as far as we're going. We got to fly because we got a space station that we all own and operate. And so that was a big part early on for my career and as a program manager.
That's a tough thing to define, right? Especially, and I'm trying to think back to that time. I wasn't at the agency at the time, but I can only imagine the tension, right? And especially post Columbia, that is this right? Is this safe enough? And of course, the certain level of anxiety to really answer the question, what is safe enough? But to establish a culture and a way of thinking, that new reporting system of making sure anyone can bring up an issue, and having that carry forward and mature and evolve over the years, right, to carry us through to where we are today. That, of course, you know, in 2005 it is very different from now in 2025. It has evolved in a certain way to get us to where we are today. And it is that balance, right, of safety, but then also knowing that, even, you know, of course, the safest thing will not be to launch. That's of course the safest option. But we have to take a certain amount of risk, and we have to explore. We have to do those bold things, and finding those that right balance. I wonder if we can zoom over to 2010, 2011 timeframe, right? This is around the period where we're starting to say, hey, we're going to phase out of the shuttle as we're approaching STS-135, the final flight of shuttle, and we have to enter into this new era, not only of a post-assembly era, but now reframing the way we think about International Space Station as, let's build this complex to let's now use it to its fullest capacity. I wonder if you can take us through your leadership there of reframing the workforce and the way that we approach operations aboard the International Space Station.
Yes, and it started really with a conversation. You know, we did return to flight. We started doing assembly. We fell into some huge challenges, and we really focused on solving the problems and creating a space station that worked. And one I'll note is when we flew Node 2, we had to retract a solar array and then redeploy a solar array. But also at that time, we had noticed that one of the giant joints that we called them the Sarge joints. It was the big alpha joints that rotated the whole end of the truss segment on both sides. One of them had this noise in the data, and so we wanted the crew to go out and take a look, and the crew went out and take a look, and it was a mess. It was just, we couldn't believe it. And of course, the Sarge joint, while there is a spare you can go to, that's a monumental undertaking. So we discovered that while the shuttle was there doing the EVA, but then shortly thereafter, we tried to deploy our solar array again on P6 solar array, and it broke, if you can recall that. And so here we are sitting attached. We can't leave because of the condition of the solar array, and the shuttle leaves, it's going to just rip it apart. So we're kind of in this position where shuttle can't go anywhere until we get the solar array fixed, or if it has to leave, we're kind of screwed. And then we have this Sarge joint that is a mess. It's just a complete mess. And, you know, that was one of those cases where we sat down with the team, said, okay, we got X amount of time with shuttle here. We've got to decide what our priorities are. And we said, hey, the priority is to go fix that solar array. And you know the result of all that. It's the infamous cufflinks that are up there today, and the solar array works. And it's really a phenomenal accomplishment. And we've also worked through the Sarge issues and cleaned it up, and it's still working today. Mm-hmm. I can remember a press conference during that that docked phase where I had this rule that said, look, you guys can do all the press conferences. I don't necessarily need to get in front of the press, but if something goes, you know, haywire, then I'll step in. And so I can remember that press conference. Oh, what was his name? Bill Harwood asked me, because I said, look, we're going to go focus on the solar array. We're not, the Sarge is just going to have to. And Harwood gave me a hard time. He said, you know, why? You know, normally you guys put teams together and you work all these different options and different why aren't you doing that? So, because we only got so many people and we got to go get this solar array fixed, or, you know, the shuttle's going to have a hard time leaving. And he couldn't wrap his head around that. But that was part and parcel to everything we had to do. It was always going to be, you can't do everything. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, this goes back to, it's not a sprint, it's a marathon. You know, mm-hmm. Shuttle flights are sprints, but station was a marathon. And so that led everything we did. We were driving to build this space station. And during those early years after return to flight, even before return, before the accident, we were driven. Everything was about how do we make the station work the best. But about the time, close to 2010, it was actually probably 2009 or so that I started pushing this. We started saying, look, you know, we see the end coming. We know what we have left to do. It's time for us to stop saying the research is going to be something that'll be done with the leftover time, because there was never any leftover crew time. So we changed the thought process. It might have been 2008. We changed the thought process and said, no, we're going to obligate this much time for research. And oh, by the way, we're going to grow that over time. So you guys, it's no more of this, we'll just do whatever we want to do all the fixing because we're fixing the space station. It's, you only have this much time to fix the space station because the rest of the time we're going to spend using it for what it was meant for. Mm-hmm. And that was a big change in our thought process. It may have been bigger than the commercial change that we ultimately went to that I'll talk to. Mm-hmm. And then also during that period, if you can recall, we started looking at options for shuttle. So that's when we said, hey, let's do the that's why SpaceX exists today and why Northrop Grumman has their vehicle and Boeing has theirs. This was all driven by this concept that now we need to, we've got to utilize this space station and get the most out of it. But shuttle's going away. So what are our options? And so the next step in our process was really the commercial, what we called the commercialization of low Earth orbit, which was really it's just a crazy way of saying, we're going to use companies that build their own hardware, we're going to utilize that. But we had to help incentivize them and put money up front to make that happen. And ultimately, the reason why we had to do that was because if NASA bought something, paid for it, a company couldn't make money off of it. It's just too hard. So you had to start with the company owning the hardware in the first place. And so that's why we had the COTS program, which first said, hey, we're going to give some money so people can go build rockets and show us that it's going to work. And then we'll select the one we like the best. Didn't quite happen like that because to get investors, you needed to show that you had a customer. So we ended up selecting the players earlier than we had planned to. But anyway, it worked out the same way. So we ended up with SpaceX and Orbital as the providers of these launch services. And then that led, of course, to crew services as well that mm-hmm. we had. That was probably, even though the commercial use of space station was a major step, that probably is what cemented the idea that the commercial use of space station and ultimately a commercial space station was able to exist and a commercial space suit was able to exist was because of that step. And again, that's a leadership. You know, Mike said, we're going to do this, and that's all the cover I needed. You know, we said this was, we think this is the right way to go. Mike said he agrees. Let's go do that. And it happened. And that was huge. And without that cover and that leadership, we would have never been able to do that. Like, there's a lots of pros and cons with the whole thing, but in the end, it is the right way for us to be as an industry if we're going to support long-term space travel. The companies have to own the assets that they're responsible for, and the agency decides which ones they want to use, and that's up to how well the company does, right? And so that whole concept was a big part of us. And in about halfway through that, so we'll say 2010 timeframe, as we saw the assembly complete, we called it, right? SCS-134, I think, was the last. But assembly complete, we started saying, okay, now we need to make time. It's not enough for the research guys to have so much time, because eventually we're going to get to 7 crew. And so with 7 crew, we're going to have plenty of crew time. So now we start saying, now not only do the space station guys have to have a limited amount of time, the research guys have to carve out so much for commercial use. And so that whole concept started as well. Mm-hmm. So that by the time we got to 2011, 2012, you know, we were kind of serious to this idea of finding commercial users. And we didn't do it great to start with. It was very, very difficult. And it's difficult because the spacecraft is owned by 15 countries. It's not owned by a company. Mm-hmm. But nobody's done it better. You know, the program continues to do it, to bring in commercial users and provide them access so they can do great things on orbit. But it's what's led to this whole idea of the thing with SpaceX and Orbital and Boeing providing these launch services is what led, and this challenge with commercial, using a government platform for commercial use, is what's driving us to, it's what drove us to a commercial space suit, and it's what's driving us to a commercial space station. Because in those cases, the owner of the hardware can sell to other customers because they own the asset. Somebody else didn't build it for them. So we've seen, I mean, this is a legacy of ISS for certain, is mm-hmm. this idea that the government is transitioned now completely to the idea that they don't have to build rockets and stuff. They can put out, you have to incentivize them, you have to give them some money to get going, but it's much less expensive, and these companies can sell to multiple providers, which lower the cost. And this is unheard of when we were flying shuttle, completely unheard of. And now today, it's normal. Most of the contracts you see have this commercial bent where NASA looks and goes, well, can a commercial provider do this? How do mm-hmm. we do that? That's how we're going to the moon. May or may not happen anytime soon, because when you build rockets and do space stuff, it takes a long time. It's hard and there's always delays. But it's the right way to do it because ultimately it helps evolve commercially to an existence. So today, if you keep doing the government owns the platforms in orbit, we will never fully utilize low Earth orbit. But when you create a platform that's a commercial platform that people can sell, their business is based on them selling the asset and selling the use of that asset, they're going to do much more with it. So when you think about where we are as an agency and what role ISS played, it's pretty phenomenal, because this agency was based on exploration. Mm-hmm. But if we want to dominate the universe, if we want to live in the universe, if we want to evolve as a species and survive bad things that could happen to this Earth, we've got to learn to live off the planet. Mm-hmm. This technique that we do today is what can allow us to live off the planet. And we did all of that. We evolved the space agency from where we started station to where we are now to that thought process. And that's just unimaginable.
You're hitting on exactly the topics that I'm hoping to stress here. All of these different changes, all of these shifts in mindset in the way that we did business, it all happened aboard the International Space Station. You had to change direction. You had to adapt to a changing climate, whether it be political or financial or whatever the landscape was. You just learned. And a lot of this transitions to what we now know today and what we're aiming towards. Even now, as we sit here, as we speak, we have a Northrop Grumman Cygnus attached to the space station. We have two SpaceX Dragons, one cargo, one crew. I mean, it is very much, and then of course all kinds of commercial companies and contractors with research and research hardware on board station now. I mean, this landscape has changed and evolved thanks to everything that the space station has allowed us to evolve to. Now I wanted to touch on just a little bit of all of these different moving parts and all of these different players. We were talking earlier about this, the reframing of this directive of just go do it to, no, let's collaborate, because now we have commercial or we have international partners and countries invested in this. Now we have this idea of a commercial element to it, and that has kind of its own flavor. Yes, it's collaborative, but then also you have to make sure it's sustainable. It could be a sustainable business model over time, and you have all of these key players with a piece of the pie that ultimately have to come together and make this one complex space station work. Now, yeah, and from the time you were started as program manager and even before, that landscape changed, right? You had a lot more players at the table. You had a lot more pieces of the pie, and you had to manage all of it. If you look at that whole landscape of this collaboration and emphasizing that international and commercial, and just how to properly manage it for human spaceflight, whether it be commercial in the future, whether it is the International Space Station, taking away some of those key themes on how to make that work when it would be so easy to just say, go do it, how to create that balance and that diplomacy at the table.
Yeah. You still have to say, go do it, and somebody has to stand behind you, right?
Of course.
So, yeah. And I don't mean that as flippantly as it sounds. Political environments are very, very important.
Sure.
And what you can get done in any given moment has a lot to do with the politics around it at the time. And really, you kept talking about my experience, research, operations, mm-hmm. engineering. Probably one of the biggest things that you learn is, I'll call it negotiation. But it really is about learning cultures, understanding people, and respecting that. And then if you start there, then the negotiations get easier. But so from a partner standpoint, it's a little different because, as I told you, the partners all are building a part of space station. So whatever, pick one, Columbus. So 11 countries, part of ESIB, built Columbus and provided ATV and a number of other things. But they have obligations, too, to their people, to the people that are paying the taxes that do this. And so those collaborations worked because we all needed to work together in order to complete the space station. And until we completed the space station, most of us didn't have much use of it. We did, and the Russians did, but the other 13 countries didn't have much use, right? And so that was a big part of the collaboration and why, as countries and this platform is such an amazing feat, is because we took these countries who all built their own things and somehow, as I said earlier, somehow every one of them worked when we brought them to orbit. The first time we plugged them in, they plugged in and they turned on and they worked. And that's just unimaginable. But it was driven by this technical need. And if we didn't do this technical thing, then we couldn't meet our political obligations. None of us could. So that's what kept us all at the table. We all had to do these things. We in the U.S., same way. We're building a space station. Where's your space station? Why isn't it built? Well, I'm waiting on the Russians. Why are you waiting on the Russians? You got to. That's not a specific example, but that's the point. So we were kind of all driven to the table, but just the things we did was pretty phenomenal. And you could get belligerent if you wanted to, but it didn't help you. We provided power to, we today provide most of the power to the space station. The Russian segment provides very little to itself. But the Russian segment's what provides the propulsive attitude control, although we're working on that. We all rely on each other to one degree or another. And what that really teaches us is that if we pick a project and say, this is what we're going to do, the more you put countries in the critical path, the better you are. We hated that. We specifically talked about not doing that early on in exploration. It's really the wrong approach. You got to have, if everybody doesn't have real skin in the game, you're not going to get what you need out of them. And what you need is a commitment and a significant investment to do this. So now that's the international forum of government spending money to go do something together. Now back up and let's talk about what commercial is. Mm-hmm. Commercial is very similar to some of this government stuff. If you have individual entities spending their own money to make it happen, now government can be given some, but it's like a good example for Axiom, since that's my most recent project, is the spacesuits and the work we do with the spacesuit. And we have Prada involved now in the spacesuit. Mm-hmm. And that was more of a government because the Italian government had such a deep role in what we were doing, that drove us to sit with Prada. Prada made an investment. We gave them suit work, and that's how we put that all together. Mm-hmm. So commercial is about doing things that allow entities and in some cases individuals to make money. I mean, it's what it is. It's very, very simple. We've been doing it for eons. But it's just getting to the point today where we can legitimately do that on orbit. But in order to do that, the government has to get further and further away, because the government's job is to create the environment where an entity can go build something that people ultimately need to do business in space. Now, let's just talk about space for a minute. Mm-hmm. And that's its role. But equally as important is it for it to step back as soon as possible and just become a customer, because that's where everybody needs to be. The government and all the users need to be customers. Of course, the other users are customers, or they don't get to fly, right? But the government can't stay deeply involved. They can't be driving. They've got to back up and say, okay, if I want to fly with you, I'm going to buy time. I've already done what I need to do, incentivize you to get to this point. Now I step back and I'm a customer. And that's commercial. Hmm. And that's where we have to head in everything we do. So we're going to go to the moon. It's going to be a little bit critical of the agency because we've had so much success, particularly with SpaceX and Boeing and now Northrop Grumman. People think, oh, well, then we'll commercialize the moon. Well, there's nothing on the moon to commercialize, and it won't be happening anytime soon. But everything we do, and you see it a little bit with some of the stuff science directorate's doing today, is incentivizing companies to go do things. These landers that are going that really are commercial landers, that's an important part of the step. Then the next step is you get to the moon and you do enough research, you find there's something that you can sell. And it takes a little time, but you got to incentivize them. Then they get to the moon, and next thing you know, you're selling water to people that can use for fuel to go places instead of coming back to, in the gravity well of Earth. Mm-hmm. So this is critically important to the success of going to Mars and beyond. And I caution us not to rush to Mars. Because we rush to Mars, we're going to be spending a lot of government money just to rush to Mars. Mm-hmm. But if we take these approaches like we're doing with the moon now, where we help incentivize the things we know we can incentivize, and we take kind of a stepwise approach, then that'll lead to things that'll help us do the same thing when we go beyond cislunar space. So that's a long-winded way of saying that what's been set up, as we said earlier, this whole trend that we set up is critically important to our well-being, because we're just not going to have the money to spend to go to Mars like it's an Apollo trip to the moon. It's just, we can't do it that way. It has to be sustainable. And you have to have the commercial element, and we got to have the partnerships. We cannot go to Mars as a handful of countries. We got to go as a species, as a planet. And we can't do it without commercial. We got to, it's just like when we went to do the gold rush, then, you know, it started off as exploration. And then you have these folks, you know, go on these short trips with a little bit of, you know, so we called that pioneering. And then ultimately we settled. So we got to use that same process as we go out in outer space. So this is, I really think this is one of the big legacies that the ISS brings to the agency and to the world, really, as a whole.
That's sort of the area that I think is the perfect place to wrap up, is continuing in this theme, right? This legacy of the International Space Station. What we've described today is the construction of the International Space Station and the transitions that it's led, sure, but then also thinking about it from start to finish on this period of evolution and a new way of doing business over decades that gets us to this moment where, you know, in your last answer, describing so passionately, this is where we need to go. We need to, and this is how we should think about human space exploration. I think it's because of all of the lessons that we've learned aboard the International Space Station, trying new things, adapting to new timeframes, and having those lessons and working through those problems, whether it be, you know, these international entities and balancing that with commercial space stations, or figuring out how to make a vacuum cleaner work, right? Whatever it is, everything in between. And you speaking so passionately about what the future holds. And that's sort of the thought that I wanted to end on, is getting your perspective of that and continue that theme of, you know, we talked about this idea of government's place and how we think about NASA and its position in enabling human exploration and furthering that, and this idea and you've talked about this as axiom on the stage of looking at low Earth orbit and this the commercialization of it and how to best approach that. I wonder, from your perspective, how you see how the International Space Station leads to this future that we are envisioning and that our now acting administrator Sean Duffy is expressing as, you know, looking at the how low Earth orbit and commercialization of low Earth orbit leads to exploration and these commercial models and how we evolve and how we get there fast and how we are competitive on the global stage. I want to hear your perspective on now, you know, looking at the legacy of the International Space Station, 25 years of continuous human presence, what you see as what's next for human exploration.
Yeah, let me say two things historically. One is the partnership, the foundation of the partnership for exploration was the ISS partnership. So that's where we all started. So that's pretty fascinating. The other big one, a lot of people don't know, you know, we've decided that we want to have this gateway platform, at least that's still out there somewhere, the idea of a gateway. And we started Gateway actually in the ISS because we had the partners together. And so we started talking about how do you build it, who would do it, what roles does each partners play. And then we had this thing called CSOC, where countries, because of common system ops costs is what that is, and because the things we provide, we have to provide as the U.S. and on our platform, the countries pay us in some item. That's why the ATV existed. That's why HTV exists. But when ATV stopped being built and the Europeans didn't want to do that, we started doing things for Orion that was a provision. So the service module was provided by Europe. That's all something we started in the ISS program before really the exploration would get to going. So that's a, you know, it's just part of the whole thing where we really did start exploration as an, I won't say an adjunct, that makes it sound like we did more than we did, but we did make major, we started major things as part of the ISS that evolve and become part of exploration. Now to talk to what you said, and you just said it all perfectly. I mean, really, it's, as I've said, if we don't do this with the eye towards commercializing everything we're doing going forward, then we won't be successful. We have to let companies build assets that they can build and turn around and sell services with on or do something in orbit they ultimately bring home and sell. We have to make that foundational. The other thing we have to do is not jump too fast. So right now, the thing to do is evolve from ISS to commercial low Earth orbit platforms. We should focus on that. We should make it successful. everybody's learning how to live in space. You do it as close as you can to terra firma, so in case things don't go the way you want, you're not far away from home. That's the whole premise of space station, and why we do the things we do on space station was all about learning to live in space without being too far away from home in case things went bad. That is why the space station is where it is. But now we've learned over the years that there's these wonderful things that can happen in space that we can do, we can build and bring home. We are now learning how to make organs. And the only place you can really build a 3D organ is in microgravity. Hmm. So, and that one just alone is fascinating. But the research potential, the drugs that have come out of space, the materials is a big one. I have this big idea about, I keep wanting to get a car company, just go take the highest stress component in the engine and go make it in space and bring it home. The data suggests, and the testing that's already been done suggests, it'll be twice as strong as its cousin made on the ground. I'd love to do that, because what it's going to show you is there's lots of applications to things you made in low Earth orbit. Mm-hmm. But we can't just jump to the moon or jump to Mars. We have to do this stepwise approach so that we learn how to drag. We do this with the eye towards bringing commercial in from the start. So you have to look to see what the opportunities are, and we won't get those all right. I think we really understand low Earth orbit because ISS has been around for 25 years, so we've learned a lot. Mm-hmm. But you want to do that in low Earth orbit. You're going to learn a lot in low Earth orbit. You're going to build a lot of stuff that you can't build on the ground that you're going to bring home. It's going to be phenomenal. This is where I think the U.S. really needs to focus its attention. It needs to get a little bit out of its shell and go, okay, if we want to be a major exporter, which the country really like to get to exporting more, then let's go build products in space that can only be built in space on a giant space station like the one we have and the ones that are being built to follow it, and then bring these products home and export them. I mean, to me, it's a phenomenal thought process. If we start building organs in space and bringing them home and exporting organs, you just can't imagine that. The materials alone that you can make in space is just, phenomenal. So we need to do this in a stepwise approach so that we learn how to do it. We learn, now commercial needs to learn to live in space. And then you go to the moon. It's a little bit closer. There's other opportunities to the moon that aren't necessarily opportunities in low Earth orbit. You should do everything in low Earth orbit you can, particularly building products that are going to come back home. Because it's closer, it's just logistically it makes more sense. But then there's going to be things in the moon you can't get anywhere but on the moon. And we're going to figure that out. And there'll be mining and all sorts of things. And then we'll be making the next step and the next step and the next step. And that approach is the way we do it at the lowest cost and sustain it and make sure it's sustainable. That's what this country has to do. It has to, whatever we do has to be sustainable so that we get the advantage. Because ultimately, everything we did on space station was about making our lives better here on Earth. And that's really the thought process that people ought to really focus on, that these things we're doing is to make us better. And ultimately, we explore because as a species, we need to make sure that we'll survive whatever happens here on Earth, and we have somewhere else to go if we have to. And so to me, that's a big driver.
Amazing. Mike Sofferdini, has been awesome to have your perspective and your experience shared with us to help us to kick off this series. I'm very excited to help tell the story of the 25th anniversary of Continuous Human Presence on Space Station, and you did an awesome job of helping us to kick it off. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it very much.
It came in peace for all mankind.
It's actually a huge honor to break a record like this.
Not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
Never Houston, welcome to space.
Hey, thanks for sticking around. I hope you learned something today. This episode is just the beginning of our International Space Station 25 series, where we'll celebrate a quarter century of continuous human presence in space with the people who made it possible and explore what comes next. You can check out the latest from around the agency at nasa.gov, and you can learn more about the International Space Station at nasa.gov/ISS. Our full collection of episodes and all the other wonderful NASA podcasts can be found at nasa.gov/podcasts. On social media, we're on the NASA Johnson Space Center pages of Facebook, X, and Instagram. If you have any questions for us or suggestions on future episodes, email us at nasa-houstonpodcast@mail.nasa.gov. This interview was recorded on September 25th, 2025. Our producer is Dane Turner. Audio engineers are Will Flato and Daniel Tohill. Our social media is managed by Kelsey Halloran. Houston, We Have a Podcast is created and is supervised by me, Gary Jordan. Special thanks to Kara Slaughter, Mary Pfister, and Greg Dorth for helping us to plan and set up these interviews. And of course, thanks again to Mike Soffredini for taking the time to come on the show. Give us a rating and feedback on whatever platform you're listening to us on, and tell us what you think of our podcast. We'll be back next week.
3, 2, 1.
This is an official NASA podcast.